You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last hour, we talked with Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Now we have Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on the line, talking through the federal response to the pandemic. The $3 trillion HEROES Act passed the House last Friday, but Senate Republicans are pushing back on a fresh round of coronavirus relief. What do you want to tell Senator Baldwin about Congress and how it should handle pandemic-related aid? We're at 800-642-1234. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a delight to join you. Thank you.
How do you feel about the HEROES Act and this $3 trillion spending relief economic aid?
Well, I think that the House has done its job in terms of taking necessary next steps with regard to our battle against this pandemic. I think that there's some different approaches that might be taken in the Senate. But as you note, there is resistance to taking up a relief package at all right now. And that concerns me greatly as I hear daily from constituents who are really, really struggling in this pandemic, whether it's our agricultural sector, our manufacturing sector, whether it's food insecurity. There are a lot of issues that have not been resolved in the or even addressed in the previous CARES Act and other actions taken amid this pandemic.
Senator Johnson said, look, the CARES Act wasn't perfect. We have to make sure that we get this $2.9 billion to the right places before we do a fresh round. What do you see there?
Well, let's take some of the things that weren't addressed, for example, in that measure. We didn't increase the availability of food stamps during this pandemic, and yet we're hearing from many constituents whose income has diminished or dropped off entirely. And literally can't afford food for their tables. And this is a big concern. Also, we're finding that the food stamp program, SNAP as it's known, doesn't have the flexibility for those who must remain quarantined to contemplate something like delivery, which others can accept. And so there's some policy changes, et cetera, in that program that I think we really need to take up. And in fact, the House passed bill does. There are any number of areas where we are seeing dire situations. We are seeing cities needing to look at laying off, furloughing employees who would be considered essential employees right now. And we can't have these basic services stopped. And so I think the stabilization of local and state governments, which are really taking the lead in fighting this pandemic, is another situation that we need to deal with further than we did in the CARES Act.
U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on the line. Let's bring in Russ now in Stoughton. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I would like to thank Senator Baldwin for all the veterans causes that she gets behind. That's much appreciated. And you're welcome. And secondly, I'm a 73-year-old Vietnam veteran. I filed my taxes last year. I still have not got my stimulus check. And I know so many people have gotten them a month, 6 weeks ago. I'm wondering, what is the delay?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There have been, obviously, most have now been distributed, but we are still finding folks that have filed their taxes and have a deposit institution should be on record with the IRS. I would be happy to tell you a couple of things. One is we have a full resource list on my my official Senate website, baldwin.senate.gov, which answers basic questions. But there is now, I think, a portal with the IRS to try to inquire. We're also happy to assist in any way we can. It has been very difficult for those who hadn't filed recent taxes, and therefore the IRS had no deposit institution
to trace it
record.
To. Yeah,
that's right. And so those have been mailed by last known mailing address. And some of those cases have been more complicated. In addition, a lot of people getting VA disability benefits or Social Security retirement benefits whose income was low enough that they did not need to file a tax form last year have had some challenges in getting their stimulus payment, the direct payment through the IRS. But we did mandate that the IRS work closely both with the VA and the Social Security Administration to use that depository information that the other agencies would have. But it hasn't been perfect, as this caller mentions, and people are still trying to hunt down
and get those checks. Let's bring in Tony now in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Good, go ahead.
Yes, Senator Baldwin, I'm kind of concerned because it seems to me the people in Washington, and I'm not pointing my finger directly at you, but I'm talking mostly about the majority leader and stuff. They're so out of touch with what's happening down on the street. I mean, 38 million people are out of jobs, and nobody can get it through their head that we need help down here. Is it going to take another depression? I mean, what is it going to take for Congress to pull their heads out of their rear ends and start helping people down at the street level?
Exactly. We need to absolutely be focused on how to safely reopen the economy, that has unfortunately not been the concern at the top. So I think one piece of advice is to contact all of your congressional representatives, your House member, contact both Senator Johnson and myself. Share what you're going through, because the only way we're going to turn somebody like Mitch McConnell around, who has said that he's not particularly interested in passing another relief package, is when they do hear a lot more about what's happening on the ground. And, you know, for me, it is something that I do daily is reach out to constituents, and certainly my staff are sharing stories. I've been hearing direct stories from folks who are essential workers in our deemed essential workers in Wisconsin, but not being able to access the protective equipment that they need to stay safe while they're at work. Those who are without employment right now have had frustrating experiences getting unemployment because the demand is so high and they're not staffed up yet fully at the state unemployment office to
and
process
Senator,
in a timely member.
Senator, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my gosh. It flew by.
It flew by. Yes. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Democratic National Convention is scheduled to take place at the Pfizer Forum in Milwaukee in August. Less than 3 months before the kickoff, Democratic Party officials are planning for different scenarios depending on the severity of the pandemic at the time. Has your business been planning, too, for the week-long convention? What's changed? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe Salmanese is CEO of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So everyone wants to know, what is the status? What is going on with this convention?
Well, we're still continuing to plan for a convention in Milwaukee the week of August 17th. One of the things that we're doing right now, which is not something that we have historically had to do in convention planning, is just trying to get a sense of how many people are coming. You know, I think there's this idea that there are two choices, right? Everybody's coming or nobody's coming. But the fact of the matter is that we'll probably fall somewhere along that spectrum. And so we're, you know, working with states and working with lots of our stakeholders to get a sense of just how many people, you know, we think we can expect, and then how do we adjust our operational planning to accommodate, you know, whatever that number might be.
We saw last week the DNC moving to allow virtual voting for the summer's convention, and our own governor, Governor Evers, recently said a virtual convention is likely. What is your take there on how Democrats nominate their presidential candidate?
So, you know, the rules as they existed really required the delegates to be there in Milwaukee and to do a range of things, from approving our party platform to, you know, obviously the most important job that they have, which is to put forward our nominee. And so we wanted to be able to do by, putting this resolution forward was to say, look, if a state plans to send 200 delegates and by August, you know, 125 decide they want to come, but 75 of them feel like, they want to stay home. They're just not confident enough in the public health environment that we're in, that we had rules in place and a system in place that it would allow for all 200 of those people to be able to vote and participate whether they're there or not. And that's really all that the resolution did, was just ensure that whether or not you're there, you're able to do the important work that delegates are charged with doing.
So take us through a scenario where you do have some in person, some not in person. What does it look like in Pfizer Forum?
So that's a good question. Well, I mean, I think in Pfizer Forum, the numbers may be impacted, but I think the first thing that we've got to do is try to get a sense of how many people we'll have. Now, of course, our delegates and our progressive partners and, you know, folks in Wisconsin, that there's lots of people who have the opportunity to be a part of it. And so, again, we've got to get a sense of what we think those numbers look like and then how it is that we will structure the actual, you know, the show, as it were, to accommodate the crowd that we have. We still, as you mentioned, the Rules and Bylaws Committee of the DNC voted to, give us the authority to make those changes. But the full DNC membership has to vote on that. And that is not complete yet. So we're waiting for that process to be over with before we really start operationalizing some of these changes.
When do you expect that vote to take place?
So it's taking place now, and it probably will be complete in the next week or so.
So how many different scenario plans do you have? How many different options or flowcharts are you looking at?
One of the interesting things about convention planning for an event of this scale and scope is that from the very beginning, from the time we got to Milwaukee last summer, you actually do scenario planning. You start from the very beginning to think about, public health crises and other kinds of things, natural disasters. As you probably know, we've had two conventions in recent memory that lost a night of programming because of a hurricane. And so, you plan for these things from the very beginning. And so this is the sort of thing we've been thinking about really since day one. And, it isn't so much a sense that you've got sort of option A, B, or C as much as, you know, as I mentioned, you sort of look at your attendance over the course of a spectrum, and you make adjustments based on where, you know, we think we might ultimately fall along that spectrum.
We're talking with Joe Solmanese, CEO of the 2020 Democratic National Convention that is set to take place in Milwaukee this August. We're looking at what it might entail and what we know now. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Joe, we're also seeing plans out of the RNC. The Republican National Convention is set to take place in August as well. You know, and that is not set to be virtual. Could precautions be taken for a large party gathering to be held safely in late summer, do you think?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like the narrative around this convention planning for both parties is very much aligned with the narrative of this election cycle. And so the president has, you know, ongoingly said that we're on the other side of this pandemic, that, you know, that it's business as usual, and that there is going to be a convention with 50,000 people in Charlotte, and that's all there is to it. You know, I can understand why people are drawn to that sort of a message, right? To the idea that, that, you know, that's certainly something that people want to hear. But, you know, we have been committed from the very beginning to be transparent about our plans, and especially to, you know, the great people of Milwaukee and Wisconsin who have welcomed us so warmly. We want to make sure that, you know, we share what we know, and that we make clear that we're interested in not just the health and safety of all the people who are coming there to participate, but the people who live there as well. And so, you know, we'll continue to do that. There are times when I think the questions can be frustrating because the answer is, I just don't know. But that's the truth.
How is the DNC communicating with city leaders in Milwaukee on the day to days of this convention and what it looks like?
So we have we communicate with city, state, you know, county leaders on a regular basis. I spoke with the mayor earlier this week, speaking to the governor's staff today, you know, but we've been in very regular conversation with them for a year now. And so, you know, we would not be nearly as successful in our planning and our preparedness had it not been for that partnership with Mayor Barrett and Governor Evers and Congresswoman Moore and Tammy Baldwin. And so, you know, sort of widening that scope to bring in, you know, public health officials, you know, has been rather seamless because we've had such a strong, you know, working partnership with those folks for the better part of a year now.
So before the pandemic, the DNC convention was expected to bring 50,000 people to Milwaukee, economic impact $200 million. Assuming it is a much smaller gathering, assuming that some of it is virtual, what would be your message right now to Milwaukee businesses and hotels who've been preparing for this moment?
So we've been in, you know, fairly regular contact with our hotel partners, you know, with our friends at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who have been just so heroic in helping us plan for this, and just trying to keep those lines of communication open. I think as you know, if and whether the numbers of people coming shrink, we will obviously be very focused on making sure that whoever comes is in downtown Milwaukee and the surrounding area. You know, we've got a very big footprint, as you probably know now, about almost, you know, sort of a 90-minute circle around the city. And so, you know, we'll adjust accordingly, and we'll, as groups are considering, you know, the events that they're doing and the venues that they'll be using, we're trying to keep those lines of communication open and make sure that, you know, that whatever economic impact we are able to have on the city, that we're thoughtful, intentional about making sure that we have it.
And so these party conventions, they provide a week of media coverage, of amped up coverage for the party to formally introduce the candidate to America, promote the party platform, as you've been talking about. Are you concerned the Democratic message will be stifled if the convention is virtual or it is a shadow of its former self?
You know, that's such a good question, because one of the things that I have felt since the beginning is that we really should take another look at these conventions, at what it is that is televised. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, you know, there's a lot of excitement about party conventions, and we come together and we do the work of a convention and it all gets televised. And, you know, there are certainly some impactful moments that the American people see while they're watching it. But I have really thought ongoingly that you know, we should think differently about our programming, about our messaging, and about who it is that we need to reach. You know, it's a nationwide and worldwide event that people take a look at, but you know, our audience in this election cycle may end up being a very small number of people in a very small number of states. So, you know, what we are really keeping centered in this is, you know, what is critically important about this, the opportunity to create a platform for Vice President Biden to share his vision forward with the American people, the opportunity for him to introduce his running mate, you know, and for the American people really to have an opportunity to learn more about him and his running mate and their plans for how it is that they're going to bring this country forward. And I think in the moment that we find ourselves in, there is intense interest in that. And so that is what we will keep centered in our planning. You know, that is what we'll make sure, you know, we have the maximum impact doing in the kind of programming that we do, regardless of the size of the crowd or the, you know, the platforms on which we deliver that message.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hope to talk to you soon.
Joe Solmanese is CEO of the 2020 Democratic National Convention, still set for Milwaukee in August. Coming up, the pandemic has stopped President Trump's rallies, kept presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden stuck at home. We explore how the battle between the presidential candidates is playing out with most campaigning moved online. Are you participating in virtual rallies? Let's talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at campaign tactics amid the pandemic. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, he reached out to rural voters in Wisconsin yesterday during an online campaign event targeting La Crosse area residents. And then later in the day, he showed up in a virtual rally in Milwaukee. GOP strategists in Wisconsin say they've been using phone calls and text messages, social media during the pandemic to campaign for President Trump's reelection. Are you checking in with presidential politics, or has it been crowded out by more pressing pandemic news and your own situation? Has the coronavirus changed what you value in the next election? Let's talk about it. We're at 800-642-1234. Alisa von Hagel is a professor of political science at UW-Superior. Alisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, normally at this time leading up to a presidential election, we'd be seeing rallies and door-to-door canvassing, tons of fundraising events, big and small. This isn't a normal campaign season. What kind of effect or, you know, what can you see right now in these social distancing campaigns?
I mean, it's totally revolutionized, you know, campaigning altogether. I mean, it's, you know, it's unrecognizable really since 2016. I mean, if you think about the, as you mentioned, the rallies and the fundraising events and, you know, all of that sort of thing, at the door-to-door canvassing, it's, I mean, there's just simply none of that anymore. And so with all of that gone, there's a huge, you know, hole or vacuum that needs to be filled. And so we see an increase in the, as you mentioned, the social media, which has been used by presidential campaigns before in different ways, but also just the Zoom rallies I've heard, or like the online rallies, and which is really quite new. And I don't know how useful or how or if they're better or worse than, you know, other rallies, but well, yes, it has absolutely changed everything.
Well, Trump Team Online, every evening, you have a gathering of people who are Zooming and going into what looks almost like this, a little bit of cable news, but also you have top leaders who show up on Trump Team Online. What do you think of it?
I mean, I think that kind of creates that same siloing, that effect that we have online already, where people kind of find the news that, or go to the websites or go to sources that fit their point of view. And then it just reinforces, you know, what they believe. And so it continually creates that siloing effect. I'm not sure how much, you know, how many new people are coming and, you know, changing their minds or changing their positions or viewpoints on the president, or if it's, you know, really just the, you know, the same group of people that are coming and just kind of reaffirming their beliefs in the president.
Well, we saw yesterday Joe Biden reaching out to Wisconsin voters with a virtual rally or a virtual roundtable in La Crosse and then a virtual rally in Milwaukee. Do we have any sense about turnout to these online events or how they are working for the campaigns?
Well, I do know that for there was an incident or not quite an incident, I guess you wouldn't call it, but with prior to the La Crosse rally, there was another online rally held by the Biden campaign that was, there was, you know, dead air. There was no camera and it was very hard to hear or to understand Vice President Biden. And so I think they're definitely, you know, need to, you know, both teams are obviously focused on stepping up the, you know, technological aspects of it. And at this point, I have not heard or read anything of numbers in terms of total people going to, you know, these types of events. However, as you mentioned that, you know, this is, you know, people who are engaged, really engaged in elections at this time of the year are those who are, you know, already decided and already know who they're going to vote for. And, you know, are that core group of people that would be out canvassing right now, perhaps, or that group of people that would be, you know, phoning their friends. And so I, especially given what's going on right now, I assume that it's not a huge number of people, but I guess if people don't have anything else to do, maybe.
So will ad buying become more important to reach voters? What will you see there?
Well, yeah, we'll continue to see the ads. We'll continue to see the ads online, on TV, if you haven't already. I know they've begun in my area. There'll be billboards or, you know, whatever kind of thing that they could purchase that would be, you know, free from the, you know, the restrictions of the social distancing. Whether or not they'll increase, it's hard to say. The president certainly does have a much higher fundraising total.
Yeah, the Republican Party starting this general election with $187 million more than the Democratic Party. What kind of influence can that have?
I mean, so the president is an incumbent, and so the incumbent does start with certain benefits, name recognition, having access to, you know, he still has his TV on TV where he, you know, briefs every day. And so he's able to reach out to people much, I think, more effectively because of his status as the president. And thus it helps his campaign. And so, so they are starting out with a huge benefit. And so whether or not the Democrats will catch up or whether or not it matters, you know, it'll be hard to say.
Talking with Elisa von Hagel, a Wisconsin political scientist, we're discussing campaigning and presidential politics amid the global health pandemic. With your thoughts, has the coronavirus situation changed what you value in the next election? How do you think November voting should be conducted during COVID-19? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We heard from Greg in Sheboygan, called in, couldn't stay with us, but Greg doesn't understand how people can vote for President Trump, especially after how the pandemic has been handled. Elisa, has the pandemic affected President Trump's approval ratings or chances for reelection?
Well, his approval rating has continued to stay pretty much, you know, there's a few blips here and there, but it continues to stay, you know, pretty much along the same trajectory, which is interesting because normally at a moment like this, with a crisis like this, we would expect a really significant rally around the flag effect where it's this, you know, there's a, you know, whether it's 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, where the nation is attacked in some sort of, you know, capacity and the nation as a whole kind of puts politics to the sides and rallies around the flag, supports the person, the leadership in charge. And we really aren't seeing that in this right now. There has been, he got a few extra points, I think, in approval starting out when the coronavirus just first started to really hit the U.S. really hard. But there really hasn't been an effect that we would expect. And so it seems as if it's not negatively affected his approval rating, but it certainly has not raised it, which one would think that it would.
Well, President Trump has been touring factories that are making personal protection equipment, like the masks and the ventilators. He'll be in Michigan today to tour the Ford plant. As you look at policy and amid this public health crisis, what do you think will show up in terms of the platforms for the two major political parties heading into November?
Well, I think, first of all, and related to kind of your overall topic this morning, is just, secure elections, ensuring that there's a process and money for, secure elections is an issue that actually Congress is working on right now. And, the two parties are fighting over with respect to certain requirements. But also for the Republicans, immigration is becoming is still a forefront. And this notion of, closing the borders or, keeping people out as a way to protect our nation, ourselves, is one, will continue to remain to be that strong, I think, issue that will still be in play, as well as, our healthcare system as a whole, the delivery of healthcare services, whether or not there's, issues of the inequalities of, the impact of the coronavirus on certain groups of people. So I think that there's just, for
a lot of unknowns, a lot of uncertainty.
Absolutely.
Well, Alisa, we heard from John from Lake Halley, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to say both parties seem to have said they won't accept the results of the November election. What will happen if one or both parties don't do that?
Constitutionally speaking, I guess it's unclear what would happen, because, political parties have no constitutional basis with respect to elections or, electing individuals to office. And so it's unclear what that maybe would most likely would lead to court cases and long drawn out court cases. And it seems like as of right now, they are fighting over, how they would use a stimulus package to ensure protections for the November elections. And so, again, we're faced with an unknown, because by November, who knows, fingers crossed, we could be, smooth sailing. It could be, over the peak, but by November, we could still have, coronavirus still ever present, where
or even even a second wave. We have UW Superior political scientist Alisa von Hagel as our guide to what presidential campaigns look like amid the pandemic. What are you hoping to see on the Democratic or Republican Party platforms? What questions do you have about party politics right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is considered one of the most critical swing states in the 2020 presidential election. Meanwhile, President Trump heads to Michigan today to tour that Ford plant producing ventilators. The trip will be the latest stop on a tour the president kicked off earlier this month to thank businesses producing PPE and important medical equipment. I was reading a Fox News reporter writing, these trips have allowed the president to make stops and grab local media attention in some of the most crucial states in the lead up to November. So how do you see campaigns changing amid the pandemic? Do you listen to Team Trump online each evening? What do you think? We're at 800-642-1234. We have UW Superior political scientist Alisa von Hagel, who stays with us. So, Elisa, House Democrats put forth legislation that would require states to send voters ballots. Republicans are moving forward with a program to recruit 50,000 volunteers to monitor polling stations. We heard from Elizabeth in Milwaukee, couldn't stay with us, but said she is concerned that Congress isn't doing anything or doing enough to have secure elections. Mm-hmm. So what effect could this all have on November?
Well, so, I mean, it's unclear. It's really unclear. And so, I mean, there's just so many unknowns and there's so many aspects of this issue that, you know, that there's vulnerabilities with, you know, the privacy or security of elections if it's mail-in, as well as if there's, you know, present in person, if there is a focus on, you know, having hand sanitizer and, you know, present at a polling location. And but then that creates a wet or sort of sticky ballot that could, you know, affect the way that it enters the machine and actually jam it. So with all these different, you know, proposals, there's, you know, there are some problems or, you know, issues that have to be addressed. And again, constitutionally speaking, it doesn't specify when the election has to be held. But we do know that President Trump's term expires January 20th, 2021. So that, I guess that would have to take an act of Congress to change that, I guess, if there was to be some sort of delay in the elections or as they figure this out.
Well, whoever thunk the wetness of hand sanitizer could impede our democratic process?
I mean, I know. It's all of these like random things that you just never think of. And then it's, you know, it is. But it, I mean, all of these things are huge issues. And you know, you hear of and the different primaries have been delayed across the country in some states, not all. And so they, you know, the parties agreed to the delaying of the primaries. But, you know, for the general election, that has never been done before. And so we're kind of at a crossroads, an unknown, really.
Well, political pundits have had their eyes on Wisconsin and other battleground states since 2016. Is that still the case? Are we still a battleground state here during a pandemic?
We're still part of that group of battleground states. Right now, the polling with respect to the battleground states overall, Wisconsin has a very, very, very close margin, and thus perhaps will be, you know, whether or not that makes it more likely, you know, to have more rallies, more fundraising, more, you know, what have you by both sides present is unclear, but Wisconsin remains that battleground territory where it's, you know, it could go either way.
We're talking with Elisa von Hagel, who teaches American Government and Gender Studies at UW-Superior. She's talking politics with us this morning as we witness a presidential campaign season during a pandemic and nothing we've seen before. What are you hoping to see out of the party platforms amid the pandemic? What questions do you have about presidential politics in this moment? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So last week, former Vice President Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders announced task forces on six policy areas. And, you know, after a long primary season, how significant will platforms and who is getting behind Biden, how will that impact how the Democratic Party gels and what Americans care about?
It's difficult right now, given that the situation, obviously. And so it's, you know, it's amazing how difficult the lack of the face-to-face interaction has for individuals, as, you know, to come together, but also, you know, to create this kind of momentum moving forward. And so it really has disturbed because of the inability to hold rallies, the inability to have those fundraising events, those meetings. It really has, I think, it hasn't perhaps halted the, you know, forward momentum, but it's it's certainly not, you know, it's held it back to a certain extent because there's just only so much you can do, you know, online or, you know, on a phone, phone call conversation. And so it's definitely affected the Democratic momentum or the unity of the Democratic Party momentum moving forward at this point.
Well, let's take a call now. Ray has thoughts on the campaigns. Ray, hi.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I just want to say that, I mean, if Mr. Trump loses and he fights going out of office, who's going to take him out? Because, I mean, the last election, he lost by 3 million votes and said it was rigged, but he still won the electoral votes. But I don't see him leaving office on his own. If he loses, he's going to fight it all the way to the bank.
Ray, thank you for the call. Elisa, what about concessions? And how much time can the president take before that they concede?
It's varied. So, again, the term expires in January 20th. So there's a, you know, considerable time in that period where the president has time to, you know, to determine whether or not he's leaving or when he's leaving the White House. And in terms of the failure to concede at all, if there's a delay in the election, it's unclear. I mean, again, I feel like I'm a broken record, but we've really not been in a position like this before where we've had this type of significant crisis that will, you know, detrimentally impact our elections. And so,
well, let me ask you this. Vice President Biden has been accused of sexual assault by a former staffer, Tara Reid. He's denied the allegation publicly. What significance does this have in American politics?
I think it's interesting. It seems to be, given the fact that there's so much, you know, everything is on the side burner for now, even the elections, because of coronavirus, that it seems to have not really taken hold or it not has gained traction, so to speak. However, on the other hand, the you know, given the Me Too movement, the fight to ensure that women who report are protected, you know, I think it's very hard. Biden's in a very precarious position to defend himself. And so doing so on, you know, through Zoom or through phone or, you know, is not, you know, an ideal circumstance. And so he's really in a bad position at this point in terms of trying to defend himself. And, but at the same time, it doesn't, you know, I don't know, it doesn't seem to have gained too much traction, given the fact that there are so many other things to be thinking and talking about.
Elisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior. She teaches American politics and gender studies. Just ahead, it's On Point, the lessons we should have learned from the 2003 SARS outbreak. 17 years ago, the world was facing a different mysterious viral respiratory disease. Dr. Ali Khan tells us what we should have learned from SARS. That's On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.